You're not allowed anything now.
Mm-mm.
Dem de rules. Dem
Normally,
de
I'm
rules.
Sat here with a beer. I'm sat here with a sparkling spring water.
Oh, wonderful. Mm. Yeah. You can still have tea, can't you?
Decaf.
Yeah, that's fine.
Decaf tea. And decaf coffee. Everything mm-hmm. has to have the good, fun stuff sucked out of it.
You'll get used to it, though.
I could have non-alcoholic beer, but what's the point?
Hey up, I'm Joe Heathcote, and this is Consistently Eccentric, a British history podcast where we try to make sense of some of the lesser known and more absurd people and events these islands have produced. So let's get started with... This story begins in the year 1554, which is now probably best known for the year when the execution of Lady Jane Grey occurred.
I feel sorry for Lady Jane Grey.
Don't we all?
Oh, she should be, well, she should be rightfully titled as Queen
She's
Jane.
Queen for 9 days, wasn't she?
I think it was actually famously. 11.
Oh. What were the two extra days coming from?
I think it's, I don't know. I swear it's not actually 9 days, though. I swear it's 11.
Well, it probably took some time to get the paperwork through or whatnot.
Yeah.
She applied for it, and then 2 days later, she got her queen license.
She was only young as well.
Well, she was 17 when she was executed on, I think it was in February. I want to say it was in February. So also, when she went out to the block, it would have been damp and cold. It's like, couldn't you just execute her in summer? At least then it's a nice walk.
Or just send her into exile. Do you know what I mean? Just leave her alone.
But it was all about, you know, they put her on the throne to try and stop the religious flip-flopping because they didn't want Catholic Mary. And then by the same sort of dint, I guess, once Mary was sort of, she put her authority there.
She had a stronghold in Norfolk.
Mm. But at that point, it was like, there were loads of plots where they were like, what we'll do is we'll break Jane out of prison, or we'll do this uprising and we'll put her up. So she, even though they were cousins, Mary's hands were kind of tied. It was the same thing with Mary, Queen of Scots, and Elizabeth later on. It was that idea of, well, unfortunately, letting you live is just too awkward for me. Nothing personal. It's just
we
a bit
are
awkward.
Related, yeah. But
I didn't really, you know, I didn't see you at a lot of birthday parties. I mean, we're related, but
I don't know who you are.
Yeah. And I'm really, really keen on remaining queen, so
I wouldn't know who half my cousins were if I walked past them on the streets.
And if, you know, you were in charge of the country and actually it made good political sense to just off them.
Yeah,
there's a temptation there.
Yeah, I'd do it.
I forgot you're very blasé about familial murder. In order to hold on to the reins of power, obviously, not just
of course
as a hobby.
Well, that too.
However, it was around the same time that Jane was losing her head that a little boy called George Somers was born in the coastal town of Lyme Regis in Dorset.
Hmm. I've never been to Dorset.
No. It's on the way. It's the Dorset, Devon, Cornwall. You kind of follow that coast down, don't you?
Have I? Is there a famous lighthouse down there?
Probably many. I'm guessing there are quite a few lighthouses along that particular stretch of coast. It's
Portland
the Jurassic,
Bay?
It's the Jurassic coastline. Have you been to the Jurassic
Bill.
Coast ever?
Yes.
There you go. Well, you've probably been near.
Okay.
He was the fourth of five sons born to a merchant father, John Summer, and his wife Alice, meaning that he had very little prospect of inheriting much wealth. And so he would have to make his own. He was going to be left to his own devices, and he was going to have to forge his own path, was
this
young George.
Can either go one way or the other.
What, you're thinking either crime or hero?
Yep.
A little bit from column A, a little bit from column B, depending on your point of view. During his childhood and his teenage years, it is reported that George spent time hanging around with a boy from nearby East Budley by the name of Walter Raleigh.
Ah, as in the sailor dude.
Oh,
Sir
as in the sailor
Walter
dude.
Riley.
Well, he was
is
a kid at this. Raleigh.
Raleigh or Riley. There's debate on this, isn't there?
As far as I'm concerned, and for the purposes of this episode, Raleigh. Because he does crop up again. And at this point, he wasn't a sir, obviously, because he was a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
I don't
Teen
know. Yeah, I'd be interested Riley. To see if anyone's ever been knighted as a child. I'm sure it must have happened.
Yeah, because people didn't live as long, did they? So I guess they had to be knighted.
Yeah, but I wonder if, you know, so that someone could, like, take an ancestral land or something or join something, you know, like, mm-hmm. they were knighting a two-year-old baby. I'm guessing it would have happened once. I'll have to look into it.
Yes.
But anyway, this time it's just old Wally from down the way. I don't know and couldn't find out what they got up to together. But what I do know is that between the town of Lyme Regis and the village of East Budley, there is another little village by the name of Beer.
Cool.
It's just called Beer.
B-E-E-R?
Yeah, village of Beer on the Dorset coast.
What should we name this place? What are you drinking? Beer. Right,
done. Regardless, much like Walter, George decided at a young age that his best chance to make a name for himself would be to become a sailor and rise through the ranks until he could become the captain of his own ship.
I don't know why anyone would want to be a sailor.
I mean, risk versus reward is probably, if you feel like you've got no other options, they're always taking on men.
That's the first thing. It's an income, isn't it, yeah. I guess. Yeah.
It's an income, it's a purpose, and there is that possibility of working your way up the ranks there. It's a bit more mm-hmm. egalitarian than certain other
and obviously if you're areas. Homosexual, then go
we're,
for it.
We're not commenting on his sexual proclivities.
I can
yet.
Say that because I am one.
Okay. Is that the rule?
Yeah.
You can say all sailors have latent homosexual urges.
Uh-huh.
Cool.
Yeah.
So that may have been another draw for him. But either way, before he'd reached the age of 16, George had managed to establish a reputation as a dependable and capable sailor before the age of 16.
Good for him.
So they're like, oh, you need a seasoned sailor on your ship. Why not try this child over here called George? We've been on many a voyage together and he...
and we've not drowned.
Yeah. What more can you ask? He was regularly sailing across the channel to France and Spain on merchant ships before returning to Lyme Regis Harbour, which is better known as the Cob.
Mm.
So they've got a special little nickname for their harbour. It's called the Cob.
Oh, why is that? Do we know?
No, but I can tell you a little bit about the harbour.
Please do.
Today, it is a Grade 1 listed structure, which was mainly built in the 19th century. However, it has a history that goes back a very, very long way, because the first written mention of the Cob is in a document from 1328 describing some storm damage that had occurred.
Well, and they were referring to it as the Cob then?
Way back then, yeah. So they think it's some old English word.
I was going to say, yeah, that's just stuck.
I mean, it doesn't look like corn on the cob or a corn cob pipe, so I'm not thinking that's where it came from, but it may be lost to the mists of history.
Is it circular?
No, it's just a traditional kind of horseshoey kind of shape now, but I mean, I don't know what it looked like back then because obviously the stoneworks have been put in and originally it was constructed from oak piles just driven into the seabed. And then
so clever.
They infilled that with boulders.
So clever.
Mm. The Cob itself has been destroyed or severely damaged by storms several times, including a particularly dramatic occasion when it was swept away in its entirety in 1377.
Jesus.
Leading to the destruction of 50 boats and 80 houses. So it was also acting as a very important sea break.
I'd be outraged.
If you were still alive.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Because it's basically just this sort of cage of wood that they've built, that they've slammed a load of boulders in. So I'm guessing when that cage fails, you just have a load of boulders as well being thrown...
That's an expensive...
At your house.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Oh, my God. The sea's firing cannons at us.
Even, like, structures that we have today, so concrete, stone, they take a battering. Mm. So wood...
Yeah.
Has no chance, does it really?
It's one of those, they were constantly having to redrive in new piles. So the upkeep of a wooden harbour in the way that they built the Cob was a constant thing.
Yeah.
You know, you were always going out and checking which ones were now too rotten, which ones needed repairing. It would have been a never-ending cycle, I reckon, mm-hmm. of going up and down that Cob.
Yeah.
Until the middle of the 18th century, the Cob was actually cut off from the land at high tide.
Okay.
Because the onshore wave action would replenish the protective shingle banks on the easterly beaches, and it naturally dredged the sand from the harbour as well.
It doesn't sound very practical.
Well, that was quite a cool thing because it meant that you at least didn't have to dredge the harbour out to keep it deep enough for the boats.
I guess so. But then you couldn't access it.
Twice a day, yeah.
Yeah.
Which I quite like because there must, you know, if he was going and meeting Walter down at Beer, there must have been mornings when George, he overslept and he had to wade through the rising tide to get there. Just like, I've got it. Oh, I'm going to miss my ship.
God damn it.
But also, you know, you've got your really valuable cargo coming in that you know is going to be like a target for thieves and things.
Oh,
but if it turns up at the wrong time, yeah, they can't unload the ship and it's just kind of sat there like a massive target.
Bobbing along.
Yeah. There's my treasure ship and in 2 hours when the causeway's open again, I'll be able to unload that. As it is now, anyone with a rowboat could go there and just take whatever steal they wanted. It. As George headed into his late 20s, he had a steady career as a sailor. But he reached a bit of a plateau, which is understandable. So he hadn't been made captain. He was dependable, no, but people didn't see him as captain material because he didn't have the right stuff.
Didn't have age on his side.
Well, he was, what, 26, 27? I imagine there were plenty of captains that age, but they were probably came from a position where they were gifted a ship from a father or an uncle or somebody. It's like, you'll be in command of this now by mm-hmm. dint of, you know, the fact that I can give you a ship to command.
I mean, I don't know if I've mentioned this before. I probably have, but it's been a while. So I was baffled when I found out that people in, like, high-ranking military positions were often just gifted the title rather than working their way up to it. So it's all a fraud, isn't it? Because people go on, like, I don't know, Antiques Roadshow, and they have all these medals and stuff, and they're like, yes, my great 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 granddad was Lord blah 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 and he worked his way up to whatever. No, he didn't. He was just gifted the title and he just happened to be in charge at the time.
Some, a little bit from one and a little bit. There were people who were able to work the way up, but yeah, you could, if you knew the right people, kind of get slotted in.
It's like honorary degrees as well, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Just get given a degree and you've not actually done anything.
Well, what they can do there is they can get a big red stamp that says honorary and they can stamp it right across the middle so that everyone's aware of the fact that this isn't saying that this person's been through a rigorous academic.
But what's the point?
It's just nice. It's recognising that someone's maybe been a champion of that particular subject.
When I...
Like, I could get an honorary degree in history, I guess. It wouldn't mean that I'm a historian, but it might recognise, you know, if this takes off.
When I was at uni, can you remember Shilpa Shetty?
Yeah, I remember Shilpa Shetty.
She graduated the same day as I did.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
That's nice. Nice little bit of... trivia. I know that at Emma's, the Ting Tings were at Emma's graduation.
Oh, I used to love the Ting Tings.
Yeah,
that's not my name.
Anyway, back to the story. Luckily for George, he had caught the eye of a young noblewoman called Joan Haywood. She looked across at this dashing, tanned sailor and went, I want a bit of rough. I'm not interested in these foppish nobles.
I want
coming
you,
to woo me,
sir.
I want him with his calloused hands and his dirty, guttural speech. Despite being nearly 10 years older than Jane, and definitely from a lower social class, she insisted on marrying George, and the pair got hitched in 1582. As part of the dowry, George received 3 houses from his new father-in-law.
Nice.
He used the rent from these, as well as financial support from his new family, to set up his own shipping enterprise.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Married well.
Oh, he married very effectively because within 5 years he'd made enough money to buy a 200-acre estate called Burn Manor,
wow,
along with the adjoining farm, which added another 100 acres. So within 5 years, he'd turned those 3 houses and a bit of seed money for his new shipping business into a 300-acre estate and a country manor.
Why does that never happen to me?
What, that you're not gifted 3 houses? Well,
yeah.
Who have you married recently?
Well, no one.
Yeah,
but...
so there you go. You need to throw yourself into the marriage market and look for a wealthy young person. 10 years your junior, so what would that be? You need to look for a 27-year-old who's swimming in money and houses. And
a 27-year-old.
Go for it.
Yeah.
This new...
story...
This fine tract of land that he managed to get in his name, it signified him as suddenly being one of the most influential people in the area. And in 1588, he was chosen to organise the defences at Lyme Regis in case of attempted invasion from the Spanish Armada.
Those pesky Spanish.
George was also wealthy enough at this point to loan three of his own ships to bolster the numbers of the English fleet during the battle. So he's like, oh, yes, yes, of course I'll take care of those sea defences. Would you like a few ships as well? I've got a few spare at the moment. They're not going anywhere.
Absolutely minted, darling.
Yeah, so I'm sure you can fit cannons somewhere on them, and then off they go. I mean, if they come back a bit dog-eared, don't worry, don't worry. It's all for Crown, isn't it? All for our Queen. Fortunately for George, though, the Armada never reached Lyme Regis.
And because of the weather.
Because of the English tactics, surely.
No, it was a storm.
No, we covered that with Evie. It was definitely the storm. Yeah. But also, his three ships returned to him relatively unscathed. So he'd done something for the royal family, which would obviously be remembered, and it had cost him nothing, except probably an afternoon sat at some fort somewhere, going, can you see them yet? No. Okay. Nevertheless, George took the fact that the Spanish had the brass neck to even attempt to invade England very personally.
How dare they?
So much so that he decided it was his duty to do something about it.
But is he going to steal something of the Spanish?
Well, it was the season for stealing stuff from the Spanish. He'd happened to receive a boost to his finances on the death of his father in 1590, which, due to a few of his brothers having also died in the interim, left him as the inheritor of his father's mercantile business.
Nice.
He allowed his father's business associates to basically continue running the business as they had beforehand.
Yeah.
And this gave him both the time and the funds to make attacking Spanish shipping a full-time hobby.
What do you do for a hobby? I attack the Spanish.
In defence of our beautiful Virgin Queen. He sought permission from Queen Elizabeth herself to become a privateer in order to be able to attack Spanish shipping semi-legally.
Okay.
Yeah, it's like, yes, you can become a thief and I will absolve you of any blame for that. It's basically what those...
Isn't that how the East India Company started as well?
It's how a lot of things started with us. Yeah. He became...
That's how America got Virginia and all that. Yeah. Were just that, off you go.
Oh, we might go to Virginia, don't you worry.
Oh, yeah, for the Virgin Queen.
I mean, I don't know how she felt about people constantly pointing that out.
That was her brand, man.
That was her brand?
Yeah.
Oh, dear. That's backing yourself into a corner.
No, not at all. Like, pure blood.
Oh, now we're getting into some rather thorny issues with pure blood. Don't want to go down there.
Okay, let's not.
He became one of a group collectively known as Elizabeth's Sea Dogs. He was one of the Sea Dogs. Aboard his ship called the Flibcoat. And I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, Flibcoat. How does that strike terror into the hearts of, you know, the people he is chasing down and attacking? Oh no, it's the Flibcoat.
That sounds like a cartoon character.
It does. But as best I can tell, because I actually tried to chase this one down, I wasn't just going to let Flibcoat go without comment. This term is from the Old English word flibbert gibbet, which Shakespeare used as a name for the devil, and coat, okay, which, as we know from Heathcote, my name, means cottage. So potentially he named his ship Devil Cottage.
Why is it pronounced...
That's the best I can come with.
Coat, but it's cot.
It started out as cot, and then it... I don't know how it changed to coat. It may have been a dialect thing that in Derbyshire...
So your name is Cottage on the Heath?
Yeah. It was named... You can go to the place that it was named for outside of a little village in Derbyshire if you want. It exists. It's there.
Does it?
The village of Heathcote exists around this sort of cottage that was up
Please there. Tell me you've got a family photo outside the sign.
My brother went there for his Duke of Edinburgh. He has a photo of himself stood by the sign. Says
you need to get all the Heathcotes in Heathcote.
And my dad has been, because he was doing some family tree stuff. So, yeah, there's a lot of Heathcotes in the churchyards around there.
In the area.
In the area. Both living and dead.
Hurrah.
But yes, as best I can tell, his ship was named Devil's Cottage, essentially.
Cool.
Which is,
cool.
I don't know if that's terrifying or not. Oh.
I mean, the cottage makes it sound quite quaint, yeah. Doesn't it?
That's it.
It's what are devil eggs, by the way? Do you know?
No.
No, I don't either. I see it on television all the time.
Yeah. I'm guessing you've added some chili to it.
Maybe.
Maybe. We're gonna...
I don't know. American people, write into us.
We have American listeners. What are deviled eggs?
Yeah, please let us know.
And we'll try and not be so sort of segue heavy for the rest of this episode, okay, if you just fine. Tell us about the deviled eggs.
Yeah, go.
Anyway, with the Devil's Cottage, his fearsome ship, he sailed for Spain in the company of three other ships with equally fierce names, like, you know, Beelzebub Sideboard.
Are you making that up?
Yeah, of course I'm making that up. But the fact that you had to ask that question.
No.
For his first taste of battle on the high seas. So this was, as far as I can tell, the first time he was in command of a ship.
He the boss.
Yeah. When he returned, he had taken around £8,000 worth of loot, which was worth well over £2 million in today's money. So it had been a good little expedition for him.
My face actually dropped then. Mm. Obviously, you can't see this because it's an audio medium. But, my face dropped.
So to put it into perspective, when he bought his, you know, manor house, that only cost him 600 quid. And he's just gone for an excursion around the coast of Spain and he's made £8,000 from that.
The thievery.
So either he's incredibly lucky in that they just so happened to be able to find a few isolated ships that were carrying naught but gold and ambergris, or he's quite a good captain.
He's talented.
And this is, you know, it's his hobby, but it could quickly become a career.
I'm going to say talented. I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt.
Either way, he thought, obviously, that stealing from the Spanish was far more profitable than cross-channel trade. Either that or he was getting bored with his wife. Because in 1595... he signed up to provide support to his old friend Sir Walter Raleigh and his El Dorado expedition. Mm. The fabled city of gold that Walter believed lay somewhere on the Orinoco River in modern-day Venezuela.
So it's a long
convinced,
way.
I'm convinced, lads. We just get to that river, sail up a little way, everything's gold.
How does he know this? Has he been there before?
No, no one's been there before because it doesn't exist. He's heard a story that sounded legitimate and someone's given him a scrap of a map and he's gone, it's worth a look. Because, you know, if we don't find El Dorado, it's the Spanish Main. We can loot and pillage and we'll still make profit.
Yeah.
So it's a win-win situation for the Sea Dogs.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
George and fellow captain Amias Preston, which is a weird mix.
I was going to say, they don't go, do they? Preston's very...
northern.
Yeah.
Mm. Down to earth.
And then Amias.
Amias is, it's not quite... it's a bit more exotic.
Oh, yeah, that's the word that I was going to use.
Mm. Mm. Well, they were supposed to be commanding support ships, basically just taking extra supplies in order to restock the main expeditionary force as and when needed. However, for some reason, they didn't set off with Walter, even though, you know, it would have made sense for your supply ships to be sailing with your ships that need supplying.
Yeah, everyone stick together.
And though they did make it to the coast of Venezuela, they were hundreds of miles west of the Orinoco River Delta and the meeting point of Trinidad and Tobago.
Mm.
So they'd gone a bit skew-whiff at some point. They were hundreds of miles out of the way. They could see that they were going to miss their rendezvous. This may have been partly because en route they'd already captured one Spanish ship, which just so happened to be in the area. So they were sailing down, like, we've got a mission. We're the support team. We're there just to help the others. Oh, look, a Spanish ship.
Get it.
Quick, kill them. It just so happened that this Spanish ship was giving a lift to some pearl fishermen, which meant there were loads of pearls on board.
They've been very lucky, haven't they?
George Sommer's luck is just insane. So, yeah, they took this small Spanish ship and it was just laden with pearls. And they were like, well, we've already made profit from this particular jaunt, haven't we?
But...
and I'm guessing that once they realised how easy it was to make massive profit by raiding themselves rather than being support ships, Sommers looked at Preston, Preston looked at Sommers, and they both kind of agreed that Walter would be fine without any extra support. He's Sir Walter Raleigh, for God's sake.
I bet he was furious when he...
Sir Walter?
Yeah.
Oh, we'll find out. But for now, these two, they've decided, you know what, we're going to launch our own expedition. And yeah. hopefully, if Sir Walter's causing loads of trouble, you know, 800 or so miles east of us, we'll have the element of surprise.
Yep, okay, fair.
All the
fair.
Spanish but forces wasn't... are already moving across.
But it's not like you can text the ship and be like, guys, this is what we're doing.
Change of plans.
Yeah. It's just, they've just made it up.
We'll try and catch up with you when we can, lols. Yeah. So they thought they may as well launch their own expedition. Preston, he was down with it, and the newly named Somers Preston Expedition made landfall at LaGuardia on June 1st, 1695. They seized three more ships in the harbour and told the Spanish settlers that they could either provide the expedition with food and supplies, or they would burn the entire town to the ground.
It's very kind of them.
Mm. Well, you've got to be clear about what you want in negotiations. You've got to set out your position early. It's like, we get all of your food. You get to have your buildings still standing.
Oh, God, it must have been terrifying if you were just like...
What, a settler on the Spanish main in some of these smaller towns? Because yeah. they had no real defences to speak of. You know, it's still mainly it's still woods construction, yeah.
It's just building up, isn't it?
Mm. So you're in that very vulnerable position. And when you see, you know, a couple of English ships coming towards you, flying English flags, you're like, oh...
I know we're not in America yet, but how the American colonies survived, I have no idea. Well, I know some of them didn't, but...
Roanoke, and there was another one,
wasn't
there? They
just kept going. Mm.
A lot of it was just throwing resources at it until something stuck. Yeah. But we'll get into it, don't worry.
Mm,
like I say, we may very well make our way over to the Americas at some point with George.
Yes.
But at the moment, we're in Venezuela. The town, they had a bit of a discussion around what they should do. Some of them were like, well, I don't actually like my house and I'd like a chance to start again, so I'm for letting it get burnt, you know.
I want a bigger house.
Yeah, if it gets burnt down, I can finally build that west wing. but the majority said, look, let's just give them food and they can take that and they'll be on the way. So they provided the Somers Preston expedition with food, and they were as good as their word. They didn't burn any of the houses down. They just burnt the three ships in the harbour.
Just.
They moved a few miles down the coast, set anchor again, and thought, well, do you know what? It was that easy to capture that little town. Let's see if we couldn't capture a bigger town. So they rowed over to shore with their new supplies, and they began a trek inward towards the settlement of Caracas, which is hopefully a town you've heard of, because now it's a city.
I actually haven't. I don't know South America very well at all, geography-wise.
Ah, fair enough. I was looking at maps, so I feel like I have an advantage. It's about, at this time, it was about 6 miles in from the coast. But it is now a major city, and at that point, it was still one of the larger sorts of settlements.
Are we still in Venezuela?
We're in Venezuela for this entire area, this time.
This section.
This section is the Venezuelan section.
Wonderful.
Now, although the Spanish settlers were able to send a warning to Caracas and say, look, we've just been shook down for food, so it's likely that you might want to just look out for the English, because they were heading your way when they sailed off.
Yeah.
The Spanish settlers within Caracas, they got all the soldiers together and they said, right, basically, from the coast, there is one road to Caracas. On either side of it is thick, thick vegetation, inhospitable mountains, so they'll have to come down the main road. So they sent all of their forces out onto this main road, arrayed, ready to sort of meet the English advance to repel them. Like, yeah. They're never even going to get to the town. We're going to stop them on the road and turn them back. Unfortunately for the Spanish, Somers and Preston were aware that a message had likely gotten through, so they decided to avoid the main road, and instead they trekked by night in the rain over nearly impassable mountains for 6 really, I can only imagine, horrible miles.
That must be brave or stupid. Like, you've never been to this place before. You have no idea where you're going. You don't know what animals are there that can kill you.
Oh, there's probably many.
And people that are going to kill you. Mental.
But what you forget is that George, he is insanely lucky. Everything works out for this guy.
Do we know his build. He must be a pretty like butch bloke. Should like do all this stuff.
Yeah, because he'd spent his entire childhood as a sailor.
Yeah,
there was, I'm guessing, not a pick on him, and he was athletic and he was very capable of, you know, commanding his men, because they made this nighttime trek through mountains. Like you say, they didn't know what the terrain held. They made it without anyone getting injured, let alone a casualty.
Jesus.
And because George is the luckiest guy who's ever existed, as they arrived, just as morning was breaking, so they did it in one night, arriving perfectly at dawn, a heavy fog rolled in, which covered up pretty much everything, because it muffled the sound of them getting closer and closer to Caracas. And also, even if someone could hear that something was going on, they couldn't see.
They didn't know where it was. Yeah.
This allowed their force to reach the town of Caracas without being detected at all.
And they could just ambush.
Yep, from the rear. The most traditional of...
ambushing.
Well, yes. But I was going to say, the most traditional of British tactics.
Yes.
We'll ambush them from the rear when they're unprepared, and then we'll say that we won a glorious battle. Who's going to question us? Them? They're dead. With the majority of the Spanish still on the main road, waiting.
Oh no, so they've just abandoned...
Yeah. They'd all marched out to meet the English, and the English had done this circuitous little route around the back and got away with it. There was only a token force left in the town to resist. They managed to win a brief battle after killing, fair enough, only a single Spanish soldier before they broke. And again, George's troops, no losses. So they took the town, and it needed them to kill just one person in order to have control of the town.
Yeah, that's mad, isn't it?
Marching into the town, the English were surprised to find that their way was actually barred.
By whom?
By a single Spaniard called Alonso Andrea de Ledesma. He was riding a horse, and he was armed with a shield and a lance.
I mean, that's not... outnumbered. He's definitely not going to win this one, is he?
But imagine that. You're walking into a town, and you think, well, you know, we've just broke the soldiery, so... we've got free reign of this place. And then a bloke rides into the town square.
You, stop.
Yeah, on a bloody horse with a lance, like it's medieval England.
Jesus.
Of course, he was promptly shot dead. Because why would you allow him to charge?
I mean, I would have run away.
However, to be fair to Somers and Preston, they were so impressed by his bravery that they ordered the men to carry his body into the centre of the town on his shield and to make sure that he received a decent burial.
Oh, well, that's kind of them.
So, like, he was a bit optimistic about what he could do here, but he tried to be a hero.
Yeah, so well done.
Yeah, I mean, he was facing down a group of Englishmen armed with muskets with a lance. It was never going to work, but bless him.
He tried.
I wonder if, you know, as he was sort of looking at all the English arrayed there, he was like, right, what I'm going to do is I'm going to go for the guy on the left. You know, like he'd done a kind of John Wick style fight routine in his head. This is how it's going to work. And then someone just shot him. It's like, oh, that never happens in John Wick.
Poor guy.
The English quickly secured the town. And when the Spanish soldiers on the main road tried to return for a spot of lunch, they found the gates were barred. Somers and Preston demanded a ransom of 30,000 ducats before they would leave the town. The Spanish settlers, they're like, okay, this is a negotiation. They said that they could possibly, if they really tried hard, give 2,000, which is significantly less. Somers and Preston decided that this couldn't possibly be true. And to make sure, they decided to ransack the place to check. And they found lots and lots of valuables. Way beyond the value of, say, 2,000 ducats. The Spanish then offered them 4,000 to leave without causing any more trouble. But Somers and Preston saw this sudden doubling of the offer as proof that the Spanish had not been negotiating fairly.
Yeah.
So they decided, well, we're going to have to teach you a lesson here, guys. You tried, you know, to be a bit remiss about how much money you had, and we feel that was unfair. So they burnt the town to the ground. So that they wouldn't lie to any future Englishmen who might come through.
It's very kind of them.
Mm-hmm. And they probably pointed at it and went, that's what you get, before whipping the bags with swag written down the side, over the shoulders.
And the whole time they're doing this, yeah. like, Sir Walter Raleigh has no idea.
No, he's
the Queen
doing
has
his own
no
thing.
Idea. Yeah. Like,
over in the Orinoco River Delta, he's having all manner of adventures, is Sir Walter Raleigh. But they know nothing of this. This is a completely, you know, rogue.
They've gone
element.
Rogue, yeah. yeah.
So they walk back through the mountain pass, back down to the ships, and then they started cruising the coast. They took four more towns with relatively few losses, and were only forced to head home eventually after the Jolly Boys outing when dysentery began ravaging the crew.
Oh, goodness.
Which eventually, as always seems to happen with naval sort of campaigns or even military campaigns, it was the disease that killed more people than mm-hmm. the fighting actually did. Yeah. That was definitely true of the Somers the Somers Preston.
It's quite that happens quite a lot in history, doesn't it? Didn't the Spanish flu kill more people than World War One?
Yeah, it was like the second fuck you after yeah. all that devastation.
Yeah. But although it was called the Spanish flu, but actually they reckon it.
No, we called it the Spanish flu. It's like yeah. other places called it like the French flu or the Belgian flu. Or
but it probably came from America originally.
Oh, the Yankee Doodle flu.
Yeah.
Fair enough. But yeah, I mean, 80 people on the ships died of dysentery, which goes to show how few, considering they took six separate settlements during their time, they lost less than 80 men from all of that engagement.
That's 80 too many in my mind.
Mm. Amazingly, though, as they decided reluctantly to turn for home because just too many guys were dying of the galloping gut rot. Can you guess who they bumped into?
Sir Walter Raleigh.
They did. They bumped into Sir Walter Raleigh's fleet.
Oh, hey,
who were
pal.
Also just so happening to be heading for home at that point. They were like, isn't that weird? We both decided at the same time it was time to go home. So they decided, while they hadn't thought it was, you know, beneficial to head out to Venezuela together, they thought they may as well head back together and spent the voyage probably swapping tales of derring do, you know, sort of comparing what they'd managed to get from the Spanish all along the coast. And you could tell that George felt like this was going to be his life from now on.
Yeah.
You know, just fitting out new ships to go on more and more of these jaunts across these expeditions across to various Spanish holdings along South America. And a second attempt, he did make a second attempt at a privateering expedition, this time to the Azores.
Okay.
But this one was cut short when a storm nearly wrecked George's ship.
I'm saying, he's mean, George.
Well, he's efficient.
Hmm.
But
although, to be fair, the Spanish did it before them, didn't they? I assume natives were living
under the Spanish thumb, those who hadn't died of...
Exactly, so yeah. It's just...
smallpox and things like that, yeah. But yeah, his ship nearly sank in a storm, so he decided, well, whew, that could have cost me money. Losing an entire ship, I don't want to risk that again. So in 1600, he decided to enlist as a captain in the Royal Navy. That way, he could kill Spaniards, but if the ship sank, he would
it
not be liable.
It wasn't his problem, yeah.
Yeah, he's not liable for the cost. He's like, well, I'd rather sail someone else's ship if I'm going to go and kill Spanish people. Over the next 3 years, George Somers was placed in command of the HMS Vanguard, the HMS Swiftsure, and the HMS War Sprite
at
various
Sprite.
Times. Yeah, that's a good name.
Mm.
That sounds like a gladiator name.
War Sprite.
Vanguard as well would be a good one.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not sure what he got up to while commanding these ships, but he was knighted in 1603. So I assume that King James was happy with his work.
Yeah.
Now in possession of a massive amount of wealth and with a knighthood, Sir George Somers resigned his commission in the Royal Navy, and finally returned home.
I'm back.
Yeah. Naturally, as a wealthy landowner, he became an MP.
Of course.
And he was elected Mayor of Lyme Regis in 1604, which must have been lovely for him.
Yeah.
You know, he was a guy who used to just work down the cob with all the other sailors, and
I've
now
got a
he
feeling it's not done. I've got a feeling that he goes over to Jamestown. Am I right?
Why would he need to? He's rich. He's got a lovely young wife, and he has no children to this point, so it might be about time that he started considering what he's going to
have on. The thrill of the chase. The thrill of the chase.
The thrill of the impregnation was what I was thinking.
Yeah.
So yeah, he was mayor of Lyme Regis, and I reckon this was the point to end your career as a privateer in luxury. You know, you've made your money. You can now have everybody doff the cap to you wherever you go and treat you with respect, even if they can't stand you.
It's not enough for him.
Mm. It would mean that it would be unlikely that he'd ever get another chance to kill a Spanish sailor again.
And that was his favourite pastime.
That was what he liked to do. So, you know, he lasted a little while, but when his old buddy, Sir Walter Raleigh, came to him with a plan to ignore Spanish claims on America and found a colony, George was happy to provide some money to help start up the Virginia Company with a plan to settle a colony called Jamestown in the Chesapeake Bay in North America.
Aren't I good?
No. He was just a shareholder at first.
Okay, fine.
You know, he's like, well, this way I can vicariously know that I'm annoying the Spanish, but other people will be doing the annoying and potential killing. I'll just sit here knowing that my money is working for me in founding a colony that the Spanish will hate.
Yeah.
However, by early 1609, it was clear that the new colony was facing a few issues. When they arrived in the Chesapeake Bay in April 1607, the area just so happened to be experiencing a rather severe drought. It was also too late in the year for them to begin to plant the crops that they had brought along with them in order to be self-sustainable.
Sounds like rogue planning to me.
Well, they'd arrived too late, but they'd assumed that, well, we've been told that this is a very verdant area. This has loads and loads of plants and things, and we'll be able to forage, you know, through that first sort of year.
But there was a drought and no
But there was
water.
A drought, so nothing was growing as it should. And it was just really, really hard to find enough food for all of the people who were there. As a result, in fact, 2/3 of the initial settlers were dead when further boats arrived in 1608. It's one hell of an attrition rate. The second and third fleets brought more hungry settlers along with supplies, who, for reasons best known to themselves, these new settlers, they decided to antagonise the local peoples rather than seeking help from them. Like, oh, look at all these indigenous Americans who've been living successfully in this land for thousands of years. Let's shoot at them. And then, like, oh, would have been good to know if this berry could be edible. Who could we ask?
Oh, no, we can't.
Yeah, and the native sort of indigenous peoples just started raiding Jamestown regularly, and anyone who tried to set up, you know, like a farmstead further afield just got immediately wrecked. Kind of prevented any sort of expansion or any sort of, you know, expanding the area that they could grow crops in. They really shot themselves in the foot by just not working with the locals.
Do you know what I learned today? Mm-hmm. It's slightly off topic. A surprise. But so native indigenous people were allowed to own slaves, and they were slave owners along with white people up until like the 18 somethings.
Wow.
Before they got stripped of being able to own slaves, which I didn't know.
No, I didn't know.
I learned that today. On a podcast,
I always thought of them being sort of separate entirely from the slave issue.
No, they were slave owners, which was a shock to me. I was like,
That's a shock to me as well.
Interesting.
Oh, Thursday's up on the console. Just give me a
Hello,
second.
Hello, Thursday.
Yes, can I help you at all?
Meow.
That was a great cat impression.
Meow.
I'm just worried she's going to trample on something that will... change what happens.
Meow.
Yeah. Thank you. So, yeah, getting back to the story after the cat impressions.
Yes.
They'd antagonised the locals, is what I'm saying. And this led to a lovely period of Jamestown history known as the starving time.
Good times.
When people were forced to eat snakes and the leather from their own shoes in order to try desperately to eke out another day of existence.
Grim.
Knowing that the colony was in danger of falling apart and failing completely like previous ones had, the company knew that they needed a hero to turn things around.
George.
Yep. In 1609, at the age of 55, Summers was appointed as the admiral of the Virginia Company's third supply relief fleet. Right, third time's the charm, and we need our lucky charm George Summers on that boat.
Yep.
On the 2nd of June, 1609, he set sail from Plymouth on the Sea Venture,
cool,
the
name.
Flagship of his 7-ship fleet. He was laden with tons of supplies, and between the 7 ships, there were 500 to 600 extra colonists.
Men and women?
Men and women. They were taking people out there. They were like, no matter how many poor English people we have to throw at Jamestown, we are not abandoning this one. If we have to be up to the 20th, 30th, 40th relief fleet with hundreds and hundreds more people, we'll just keep going with this.
I don't know if this is too early, but I know at some point when they were sending people over there, they were basically sending, like, they were advertising for women to get married to gentlemen over there, but there were too many women to the men, so that the men had to pick. They literally were like, yes, I'll marry you.
This is still sort of like the pioneer time, so this was before it was established, so I think it was families that they were sending over rather than eligible young ladies.
Can you imagine getting there and being like picked last, like at sports day?
Oh, you've gone all the way over there to find a husband, and it's not like if they all reject you, you can just go home. You're just stuck there.
You're a spinster in a town that no one knows you.
Yeah, on the other side of the world from all your friends and family and people who might, you know, help you, look after you in your dotage. Yeah. The issue was with this third supply fleet, though, that George Summers's prodigious luck, this was the moment it finally deserted him. And he ran the fleet directly into a hurricane, which naturally separated the ships. It scattered them all over the place. Aboard the Sea Venture, Summers fought the storm for 3 full days.
Jesus.
Now, although his ship was large enough to withstand even a major storm, it turned out that the Sea Venture had a fatal flaw. In order to provide Sir George Summers with a ship worthy of his position, you know, he's a knight of the realm, the Virginia Company had ordered it built from scratch just before the expedition. So this was its maiden voyage.
Okay. Had they tested it?
They hadn't tested it. And it was so new, in fact, that by the time they hit the storm, the timbers had not set. This meant that the caulking was quickly forced out from between them and the ship began to leak badly.
Oh, God.
So it became a giant wooden sieve, is what I'm saying.
Yep. Death is in the air.
Sailors and colonists alike were tasked with constant bailing. But even with the effort of nearly 150 people, high on adrenaline and fear, working constantly, the water continued to rise.
That must be terrifying, man.
Yeah. Inexorably building its way up the hold. Anything not considered essential was thrown overboard to raise the buoyancy. But this only really delayed the inevitable. Throughout the 3 days of struggle, it is reported that Sir George Summers remained at the helm. So the reports were that he didn't sleep. As soon as they hit that storm, he was in command of his ship.
I mean, how
and he
can you sleep
in
that situation?
It is a good point. But you may have taken a rest of some description and let someone else take the helm, but he was like, no. If this goes good or ill, I'm the one who's going to be in charge. I'm not risking
someone else.
Captain
always goes down with his ship. Allegedly.
Well, luckily, it didn't come to that.
Okay.
Because on the morning of the 28th of July, 1609, George Summers spotted land. The water in the hold by this time had risen to 9 feet.
Jesus.
And the crew and the passengers were way beyond the point of exhaustion. Summers knew that he was running out of options, and he made the decision to deliberately drive the ship onto the reefs near the shore in order to prevent the ship from fully sinking.
Yeah, wise.
Well, it was an incredibly risky strategy, but it was a wise one.
Yeah.
Because it worked, and the ship got stuck fast. I mean, it was never going to sail again because there were huge gashes ripped in it, but it was stable enough.
Yeah.
And it ensured that all 150 people and the dog aboard, because there was a dog.
Of course.
I don't know what he was doing during the storm, but that must have been a bad time for that dog.
Probably just wanted to swim.
Yeah.
I want to swim.
Let me off! Let me off! Somebody chasing a dog around the deck the entire time. Going, no!
Fenton!
Fenton! Get back here! Swim back! Oh, Jesus Christ! Fenton! but they were all able to reach the shore safely. Meanwhile, the rest of the fleet, having not seen Somers' ship for over 3 days, they just assumed that the Sea Venture had sunk in the storm with the loss of everyone. Like, well, he's gone.
He did.
So after they made the way out of the storm, they sort of found each other, repaired what damage that they could, and limped onwards towards Jamestown.
Yeah.
Luckily for George and everyone on board, of all the places to have been shipwrecked, Somers had happened to have crashed into Bermuda, a genuine tropical paradise. Food was apparently plentiful, with lots of small pigs and other animals that had no fear of humans because they'd never really encountered them before. And the shallow waters were jam-packed with fish. There were also ample supplies for building, including some very lightweight but sturdy cedar trees.
So this had saved them being shipwrecked on this island?
Oh, definitely, because while they weren't busy hunting, which didn't take up a lot of their time apparently, they managed to have the wherewithal to build houses and even a little church.
How big is Bermuda?
It's quite big, actually. It's a big island. It's got a couple of fair-sized towns on it.
Is Bermuda still a British territory?
Technically, yes. Yes, it is.
So strategically,
This
very
is
well placed. Yeah.
Well, it was strategically very well placed for George Somers and the rest of the people on the Sea Venture because it hadn't been placed there. Yeah, we'd have never heard of them again.
Yeah.
But yeah, they had time. They were building the church. It was lovely. And this proto-village became the start of the Bermuda colony.
Nice.
It was called Bermuda for a Spanish captain called Juan de Bermudez, who had reportedly discovered the island in 1511. However, due to the reefs and the regular hurricanes in the area, it was deemed not suitable as a site for a Spanish colony. So, like, we know it's there, we've named it. There's nothing. It's not worthwhile.
I'm surprised the British didn't rename it something else, like they did with New York, that used to be called New Amsterdam.
Give it time.
The Dutch.
They're just shipwrecked there at the moment. Give it time.
Okay.
Saying that the Spanish didn't want it is not to say that humans had not lived there before Somers had rocked up. A Frenchman called Russell was wrecked there in 1570, followed by the Englishman Henry May in 1593. But both had managed to escape. Although, why you'd want to escape somewhere that had plentiful fresh water, food, yada, yada, yada. Maybe
unless
it's more difficult
trying
if you're
to get
on your
home.
Own.
Yeah.
Without, I mean, although the ship was wrecked, they were able to take a lot of the stuff from the ship, so they would have had the tools that they needed.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it's completely different if you're naked and alone on an island, isn't it?
Yeah, that's no fun for anyone.
Another Spanish, called Captain Diego Ramirez, was stranded on the rocks of Bermuda after a storm in 1603. But again, he didn't see it as a place where humans should be setting up shop. This was mainly because he heard some screaming sounds, and he assumed that this meant that the island was overrun with demons.
Was it just whistling of the wind, potentially?
Close.
Or animals?
Yeah. It turned out to be nesting terns.
Yeah.
So it was just some seabirds. And you'd think, as a sailor, he'd know the sound of seabirds, but these particular seabirds had a particularly humanistic kind
he'd
of call.
Probably just it was if you're shipwrecked, it's probably quite traumatic, isn't it? So you're probably just thinking that everything's trying to kill you.
Yeah, I get that, but you can imagine that. Oh, you were on Bermuda. How was it? Demons. It's just covered in demons. We won't be going there. It's a demon island full of demons. Okay.
It's the Devil's Cottage.
Somers and his company. It's the Devil's Cottage. Yeah. Don't go to Bermuda. They say it's the Devil's Cottage.
Is the new phrase you shall be hearing from me all the time.
It's the Devil's Cottage. Yeah, yeah. If you take that from this episode, it's fine. Just describe things as the Devil's Cottage.
I shall.
Somers and his company, they didn't find any demons during their time there. And they spent a very happy 10 months in Bermuda.
Oh, nice.
Living on the food they could gather. And the fish from the sea, obviously. Some people believe that this incident with George Somers and his expedition inspired William Shakespeare's play The Tempest, which was likely written in around 1611. So
in Bermuda.
The year after. It was written the year after this incident occurred.
So it's just copying stories, isn't it, really? Nothing's original.
Nothing's original, but It's nice that it was kind of, you know, he was obviously reading the local news, and it's like, oh, do you know what that'd be? That sounds fantastical.
That's how Agatha Christie got most of her stories as well. She basically just stole them from newspapers.
Mm. Well, I don't care how she did it. They were great.
Oh, no, they were. I agree.
Mm. Actually, to be fair, our kids saw a bit of a Poirot. And it involved a woman shooting another woman, and it did not go down well. They have been very concerned.
Traumatised.
Yeah.
But did Milo enjoy the moustache? I know he likes the moustache.
Do you know what? He didn't comment on it. I'll have to ask him if he likes that moustache.
I just always remember him sitting on my knee twiddling mine.
Yeah. He told me I should grow a moustache, and I said, Milo, I have a moustache. And he went, no, you have a beard. I was like, yes, I have a beard and a moustache. They're just kind of
he
joined.
He just wants the moustache.
And it blew his mind a little. Mm. I was like, oh, Daddy has a moustache. Well, yeah, it's always been on my face since
you've
known
draw
me.
One on him. Give him one. Mm. With eyeliner.
Don't worry, he'll grow one soon enough.
Yeah, good.
Mm. I'm sure once he can grow his own, he'll be complete. But Summers, even though he's enjoying the island life, I'm imagining him sort of coconut in hand. Sipping while he's, you know, all of his new
with a little umbrella in his cocktail, yeah,
enjoying themselves on the beach, playing beach volleyball or whatnot. He wasn't the kind of guy to just wait for rescue. He's like, well, it's been nice, but we do need to eventually get to Jamestown and help them out. And look, we've got so many supplies here, we could bag up a load of Bermuda food and we could take that over to Jamestown to replace the supplies that we've lost. And he and another knight of the realm, Sir Thomas Gates, decided, well, we're going to have to do this ourselves. Because we could be waiting here months, years.
Yeah.
Accordingly, they oversaw the construction of not one, but two small ships.
That's impressive, isn't it? At least they've got the people that can build them.
Well, I don't know that there was a shipwright on there, but you imagine there must have been.
Yeah.
I mean, he was a good sailor, but that's completely different to making a ship. But they made two ships. They were called the Deliverance and the Patience. They were built from the local timber, the Bermuda cedar, which was also not just good for houses, it's good for ships. And they salvaged the spars and the rigging and other bits and bobs from the Sea Venture to sort of make up the difference.
Yeah.
Throughout all of this hardship, in May of 1610, the ships were ready to set sail for Jamestown.
Brilliant.
They'd lost no one.
So the luck continues.
Yeah, he'd lost nobody. A few people were left behind on Bermuda to keep the new colony going because George Summers was like, well, this place is amazing.
Is great. Yeah.
It's got so much food. It's got strategic significance. We can use this. So you guys stay here and make sure that if anyone else comes, they're clear that we've called dibs.
Yeah.
And we'll go and save the other colony.
And breed, have babies.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yes. You do whatever you can to make sure. I want to see six strapping young babes in arms by the time I get back here.
Go.
But yes, everyone else jumped on board these two new ships to take the food from the island in order to provide some level of resupply to the Jamestown colonists. When they reached the settlement, they found that it was damn near destroyed by the famine and the disease of the starving time.
Yeah.
Because that had been going on for a year. You know, they were way beyond having eaten the shoe leather.
God.
Pretty sure there would have been some anthropophagy. Some cannibalism in there.
It's how America survived. Mm. I had no idea. In modern form. I know people were there before.
This was because it turned out that only a few of the supplies from the rest of the Third Relief Fleet had actually arrived.
Oh.
Because, like I say, the same hurricane which caught the Sea Venture, it had damaged those guys as well, and probably during the storm they'd lost a lot of their supplies.
Yeah.
And because the voyage with damaged ships took longer from that point, they'd had to eat more of the supplies in order to get there. It was all just a bit of a poop
show. A bit of a knock-on effect.
Yeah, and by the time these guys arrived, there were only a handful of settlers left, to be fair. It turned out that it was only the food and help offered by those on the two small ships from Bermuda, followed by a relief fleet in July of 1610, commanded by Lord Delaware, that enabled the colony to survive and avoid the abandonment of Jamestown, proving, without a doubt, that Sir George Summers was indeed the right person to have asked to lead the mission to save the colony.
So literally, without him?
Yeah, though Jamestown would have failed.
Yeah.
it's unlikely then the Virginia Company would have had the funds to go again. So that would possibly have been it.
Been the end, yeah.
Yeah. Or, you know, maybe someone else would have had a go. And maybe it would have been a different colonial power that had sort of taken on the North American East Seaboard. But definitely, if he'd have decided when they'd made those two ships to go, do you know what, we're just going to sail home, that could have been it for Jamestown.
Yeah.
Of course, they'd arrived in Jamestown. George had looked around the place. And he realised that Jamestown, as it was a bit of a shithole in comparison to where he'd just come from. He's like, I've come from a tropical paradise where we built this? A lovely little village with its own little church, and we had all the fresh food you could want, and everyone was happy. And no one had died.
Yeah.
Even though they were essentially shipwrecked. You guys planned to come here to the Chesapeake Bay. You had ample time to supply whatever you wanted on those ships that you sailed out on. And you're all dead or dying, and you smell. And why are the locals so angry with you? What did you do? For God's sake. So he decided that he was going to return to Bermuda as soon as he could, in the patience. Although he said it was with a plan to collect more food to bring back, because
he just wanted back there. He was like, I ain't doing this.
So he got on board with a small crew, which included his nephew, Matthew Summers. Matthew was actually the second son of George's brother.
Okay.
However, he believed himself to be George's favourite nephew. And he convinced himself that his uncle, bearing in mind George hadn't got round to having his own kids, was grooming him for taking over the family business in lieu of his older brother, Nicholas, who was actually next in line to inherit.
Okay.
The fact was, it was probably more likely that George had his nephew along to give him a chance to learn the same set of skills that he had learnt when he was a young man who was unlikely to benefit from a fat inheritance. So he's like, yeah, I'm going to take you along to give you a serviceable skill. You could become a sea captain because your brother's going to get the business. So you're going to need to actually...
You're going to need some skill or some path. Yeah.
But Matthew, he decided, no, I'm the chosen one. I was asked to come on this trip. I almost died in a hurricane. That means that, you know, I'm going to get the business because I've worked for it. So just ignore the way inheritance works.
Is he the second son?
He's the second son, is Matthew. Nicholas is the oldest.
I'm the second son too.
So you know this feeling.
Mm. Yeah.
Records state that on the return journey to Bermuda, George Summers suddenly fell ill. Now, I'm not saying that he told his nephew that he was not changing his will and that Matthew decided to take matters into his own hands. But what I am saying is that George was only 56 and he had been in fine health up until this point.
Oh.
And there was only a small crew, and it was him and Matthew, and they were obviously talking business. And Matthew was probably, so when I take over, and George would have said, well, no, you don't. Nicholas takes over, obviously. But you could be a good lieutenant to him. You could be his right-hand man.
Yeah.
You could be his number one guy.
Family drama. Mm.
Upon arriving in Bermuda, George tried his best to carry on organising the loading of the food to take back to Jamestown. However, he deteriorated rapidly from an unknown illness.
Was he poisoned?
This is what I'm saying. I can't prove it, and obviously it's a wild theory that has no records to back it up. But going off human nature, I think that's what happened.
Yeah, he wanted him gone.
And George Summer finally died on November the 9th, 1610.
After all that?
After surviving a hurricane, after surviving 10 months as a shipwreck, after saving Jamestown, he died less than a year after all of that. Possibly at the hands of a disgruntled nephew.
Families, you can't trust them.
Reportedly, George had said he would be happy to be buried in the burgeoning new settlement on Bermuda.
He's got a real thing for Bermuda, hasn't he? He loves it.
He wished he was born there. It's like, why have I spent the first 55 years of my life not in Bermuda? Do you know, I feel like wearing shorts. Oh. But he was happy to be buried there. And at least part of him was. It is said that his heart and entrails were buried in the centre of the town, which was later named St George's, in his honour.
Why would they only bury that part of him?
Because when you're embalming a body...
You have to take
all those soft bits out. So they thought, well, he did say he wanted to be buried in Bermuda, so we'll put his heart here. apparently, because he was buried near the main road, the heart, the main road's been expanded over time. So he's now probably, his heart's somewhere under the tarmac of the road. Which is, I mean, he's still in the centre of the town. It's just, there's no big sort of monument to him. It's just
no plaque.
The road. There is, but it's, you know, it's somewhere near here.
In the wrong place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not only was the town, St. George's, kind of named in his honour, but for a while, the English renamed Bermuda to the Summer Isles. And this name does remain as an alternative that can be used to this very day. It's just not used that often. And the first time I heard of this, you know, Bermuda was also known as the Summer Isles, I thought summer as in sunny.
Yeah.
You know, it's the Summer Isles because it's always sunny. I didn't realise it was named for a guy.
No, I didn't either.
Which is really nice.
Yeah. Good for him.
Now, the reason only part of his body was buried is that his nephew Matthew had a plan.
What's Matthew up to?
Well, this is why I think he poisoned him, because he immediately, after his uncle had died, he changed everything around and he decided that rather than return with supplies to Jamestown, like they were expecting and like they'd said they would do, he would instead return to England with the freshly embalmed body of his uncle.
Okay.
Now, this was not out of some familial duty. I think, you know, George's wife, she'd given up on him by this point.
Yeah.
She was just like, I'm going to live childless and alone, but at least I've got a lot of money.
Yeah.
She
could probably have it off with someone.
Yeah, I'll have a string of affairs while he's away. Just keep him discreet. It's fine. We shouldn't besmirch her good name. I have no evidence to say that she had affairs. But it was the reason he was taking the body over was so that he could prove that the death had actually occurred and claim the inheritance. As he just so happened to be in possession of a brand new will that named him as the main benefactor.
Interesting. Yeah, he definitely killed him.
That is why the remainder of George's body was buried in his home hamlet of Whitchurch, near to the town of Lyme Regis.
Oh.
So he's buried in one place, his heart's buried in another.
Jet setter.
I don't know what that would mean for being a ghost. Would you go with the heart? Would you go with the body? Or does he do like a timeshare now?
Timeshare.
He haunts Lyme Regis.
50-50.
I don't know. Is Bermuda across the equator? Because if so, you could haunt in Bermuda summer, and then you could go over to Lyme Regis in sort of northern hemisphere summer, so you never have to see another winter.
Hmm.
What a great way to spend the afterlife.
Yeah.
Anyway, Matthew. His plan to claim the inheritance ultimately backfired, as the validity of the new will was questioned almost immediately. And with there being a question around whether, you know, this was actually written by George, whether there was some forgery or some chicanery around, the lawyers just decided it was much easier all round if they just stuck to the sort of paternal male line of succession.
So it went to his brother?
Yeah, Nicholas got everything. Nicholas, who'd been sat at home, didn't know about any of these sort of plots and schemes of his little brother. He's like, oh, you've brought Uncle George back and he doesn't have a heart. I guess that means I own everything. And he flapped a will down and went, no, look, he wrote a new super secret will while we were away together and that he loves me the most and that I get everything. And Nicholas went, okay, we'll ask the lawyers, shall we? And the lawyers just, no, we have a will here that he wrote that had a notary and everything. You've got a piece of scribbled paper. This is a will. What you have is a fantasy, Matthew.
You'd lose.
He did lose because he'd really been banking on that money and he launched a few legal challenges which racked up the debts. And the last we heard from Matthew, the last document, is a letter he wrote from prison, from debtor's prison, demanding that the Virginia Company reimburse him half of the £470 initial stake that George has invested.
So was his brother just having none of it?
Yeah, his brother was just like, nah, mate, this is mine.
Yeah, you effed up.
And you obviously appear to be a bit of a dick.
Yeah.
I was going to, you know, you were going to be my right-hand man.
But you've ruined it.
Yeah, it feels like you'd just be looking for a way to backstab me or potentially poison me.
Kill me, yeah.
Yeah. So he went straight to the Virginia Company, went, you owe this money, and as his heir, I should be getting this money. The Virginia Company responded by saying that they'd already provided all of the owed money to the rightful heir, Nicholas, and that they would not be providing any more. So the assumption has to be that Matthew eventually died in debtor's prison. We don't know what happened to him.
Jesus.
Yeah. Bermuda is now the oldest British overseas territory in existence. Though today it does have self-governing status, which is nice. And it's thanks in no small part to the strange luck of George Summers, which ultimately may have run out at the hands of a greedy nephew in a tropical paradise. But at least he didn't die at the hands of the Spanish.
There is that.
And the main source for this story was an article from thebermudan.com called Searching for Sir George, which was written by Michael Jarvis. And it was actually only written in October last year. It's well worth checking out. Because this guy went both to Bermuda to look for the heart, and he went to Lyme Regis to try and find both burial sites. And it's all told through sort of him going and looking for these things, but also recounting the story.
That is interesting.
It's well worth a read if you want to. But there you go.
You've just summarised it for me, so I don't need to. You've done very well.
That's the story of Sir George Summers, who accidentally founded a colony on Bermuda and was murdered. Almost definitely was murdered. Cut down in the prime of his life at just a young 56.
I found that very interesting. There was pockets of that I did know.
Yeah.
But it was nice to see the lineage of it strung together.
The original thing that spurred this story was I was handed some coins from a person I worked with called Claire. Okay. She said, my mum's got a load of old coins, and she handed me them. She said, you probably like old coins? I'm like, yeah, of course I do. And I found one that had a ship on one side and a hog on the other and said Summer Isles on it with a date.
So you had to do some investigating.
Well, yeah, I did. I looked it up and I found out that these coins were minted as currency on Bermuda, and they were very, very rare and very, very, you know, expensive now if you wanted to buy one. And I thought, oh my God, I've been gifted something. It turns out it is a replica.
It doesn't matter, does it? It still give you inspiration.
Well, it matters in that I could have been maybe 20 grand better off.
That's your new roof.
Yeah, sorted. Could have paid for the new roof. That starts tomorrow. But
Is the scaffolding up?
No, the scaffolding's going up tomorrow, finally.
Exciting.
But, yeah, that coin, if it had been genuine. I still have it. I'll send you a photo, but...
Well, maybe that should be the photo for the...
For the episode.
For the Instagram.
For the Instagram. Well, I haven't even done the one for this week's. Blimey.
Well, you better get
I'm
on
so
it.
Far behind, yes.
The one about the barrel and the bell. Yeah. I listened to it the other day.
Yeah, that will be going up with Evie's artist's impression of the barrel.
Oh, did she draw it in the end?
She did. She drew me a picture of the barrel.
Amazing. Does it look similar?
Do you know? It's not a million miles away.
Oh,
she's done quite a good job, to be fair to her.
Good.
But yeah, so there you go. That's George Summer.
I enjoyed that.
Good. I'm glad you did. It's nice to hear about a guy who, you know...
Got poisoned.
Well...
Hi there, it's Emma, Chief Organiser at Consistently Eccentric. Here to remind you all that if you like what you hear, you can catch up with all previous episodes and session series by searching for us on Acast, Spotify and iTunes. How fancy. You can also join us on Instagram at Consistently Eccentric Podcast, where we update on the weekly episode and post all of our bonus content for you lucky lot. See you next week.